Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. Books.
Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today I have, for me, the wonderful honor of talking to W.S. Merwin. We've talked before, but now, since the last time, he has both won another Pulitzer Prize and been named the Poet Laureate of the United States, and his conservancy in Hawaii has been made a national conservancy, so the plants and palm trees that he's been working to preserve are protected now. So it's a very great pleasure to see William Merwin, W.S. Merwin, with me here. We're in the Hotel Palomar. The sounds you may hear are the sounds of a busy hotel restaurant, and it's an honor and pleasure to see you.
Thank you, Michael.
Now, one of the things I found in the newest book, which is The Shadow of Sirius, is a poem that's translated from the Latin by the Emperor Hadrian. And it is a truly mysterious poem, especially because it is the only poem that we know Hadrian to have written. And I thought we'd begin by listening to it because, like much of your own poetry, it's an address to the soul. This is W.S. Merwin reading a translation after Hadrian.
Little soul, little stray, little drifter, now where will you stay? All pale and all alone, after the way you used to make fun of things. It's a poem that I've known since I was, when I think of that, I think always of where I was staying on the campus. I know how old I was. I was very young, since I was in my late teens. And I was immediately taken by it. As far as I know, no one has ever challenged the ascription to the Emperor Hadrian. But the thing that makes that extraordinary is not that the scholars are being particularly self-restrained, but that it's amazing to think that if that's the only poem he ever wrote, he wrote something as remarkable and as masterful and as simple, and it's a small masterpiece, that poem. Nobody knows who it's addressed to. Nobody knows exactly when he would have written it, if he did write it, which he probably did. We don't know anything about it. And the other remarkable thing about it, I think, is the sort of clue, which is very intimate and very private, and was the bane of translators for forever, which is that last line. Little soul, little stray, little drifter, now where will you stay? All pale and all alone, after the way you used to make fun of things. And over the years I read every English translation I could find, and so every French and Spanish translation I could find. And the last line was something that if they got the rest of the poem, they didn't get that. I mean, it just, they didn't know how to deal with it. It's always something much too heavy-handed, you know. And it's not. You don't know to what degree he's taking it lightly. And you don't know how many shades of irony there are in that. It's part of the mystery.
And yet it could be addressed to the soul of a satiric poet.
Sure, it could be addressed, as some people assume it is, to himself. So one goes on speculating about it. I never in all my life thought of translating it or trying to translate it. But I had been writing over a period of quite a few months, a number of small elegiac poems, all of which have to do with dogs. And everybody smiles when one says that, but I don't see why one loves what one loves, you know, and one grieves for what one grieves. And the griefs are just as real, depending, it doesn't matter what they are. And I was doing something in the garden, not thinking about writing anything, and all of a sudden, this poem, I suppose the first line would keep ringing in one's head, as in my head, as it probably always had. And I just thought of the poem, and the translation sort of floated to the surface just the way it is.
There's a beautiful and nearly formal poem to a black dog in this book. I wonder if you would read it for us.
Oh, yes. It's called By Dark. And some people thought that when it was first circulated that it was... Churchill talked about the black dog. He was always talking about depression. I said, oh, it's a black dog. Never mind symbolism and metaphor. By dark. When it is time, I follow the black dog into the darkness that is the mind of day. I can see nothing there but the black dog, the dog I know, going ahead of me, not looking back. Oh, it is the black dog I trust now in my turn after the years when I had all the trust of the black dog through an age of brightness and through shadow on into the blindness of the black dog where the rooms of the dark were already known and had no fear in them for the black dog leading me carefully up the blind stairs.
W.S. Merwin, reading from his most recent book, the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Shadow of Sirius. Now, one of the things that I love about these poems, as always, your poetry records evanescence, the passing of things, and allows it to reverberate against the memory of things. But now,
it's wonderful.
In these poems, thank you, blindness, darkness, inadequate recall start to create shadings, pastel hues of things about to disappear, and darknesses where no darkness is. Of course, you know, you become for us the man we are privileged to watch writing poetry into old age and letting us see how poetry captures the effects of aging. For us, it's a great honor to have a poet this delicate telling us about the things that, if we're lucky, are going to happen to us.
Thank you, Michael.
Tell me, as you write now, because you bring both the confidence and the consciousness of age, what is it like to create these poems that flicker into evanescence as you hear them?
It's like what it is. I mean, it's in some ways the way it's always been. You know, when I try to write about what's there, and one of the good things about it is that other expectations fall away. You know, there are so many things that one thought that I thought I had to do that I don't have to do at all. There's almost nothing I have to do. And as I was talking with people in two other arts, and I said, what one always hopes for is that one can have it just right and make it look as though nothing had happened, you know, as though it had happened all by itself.
For me, what's marvelous is that the black dog could easily, without any interpretive effort, be the soul. It can be leading one into the next world, or at least a world of greater darkness. We know a hellish dog, Cerberus, who, you know, inhabits the inferno. And all of this happens so easily in your poem. He's also, in this poem, a guide dog for a blind man.
He is both, or it is she, in fact, both a guide dog, but it's the dog who's blind. And the dog who's leading, and the dog who's leading in the dark, you know, that, you know, on into the blindness of the black dog. You know.
I'm speaking to W.S. Merwin on several occasions, the occasion of his Pulitzer Prize, of the wonderful book, The Shadow of Sirius. You know, I'm going to ask you to explain the title to me, because I find myself darkening each time I try to remember it.
That's
Tell
good.
Me about The Shadow of Sirius.
There are many meanings which do not exhaust what it's supposed to be, but Sirius is the dog star, and the center part of the book is the dog poems. But that's a kind of private half-joke part of the title. Sirius is the brightest star in the visible heaven. And so there is no shadow of Sirius. But what is the brightest star in the middle of our own sky?
The sun.
Hmm?
The sun?
No.
What, Sirius?
Michael. Who's the brightest star in the middle of your heaven?
Please tell me.
Michael.
Michael?
Yes.
What do you mean?
You're the center of you're the brightness of when you wake up in the morning. Where's the light coming from? It's coming from you.
And then.
And there's no shadow. The shadow also is in your mind. So it's a metaphoric shadow.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to KCRW's Bookworm. We're recording today in the Palomar Hotel, where occasional clinking of cutlery and coffee cup will be, I hope, excused, because I'm talking with W.S. Merwin, author of The Shadow of Sirius, which won the Pulitzer Prize, and who is currently the Poet Laureate of the United States. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with W.S. Merwin, author of The Shadow of Sirius, which won the Pulitzer Prize, and who is currently the Poet Laureate of the United States. I found in The Shadow of Sirius some of the most mysterious poetry in a lifetime of mysterious poetry, because in the course of this book, I realized that by now the gift given to W.S. Merwin is a gift of allowing an image to shadow itself with another image. So it doesn't require four words to do two words' work. It's always the extreme concision and the way in which the language doubles, and so it is like a dream that what has been said is also what has been unsaid. I'm going to ask him to read another of the dog poems, and I think you'll see what I mean.
the title is A Dream of Koa Returning. Koa is the dog's name. Sitting on the steps of that cabin that I had always known, with its porch and gray-painted floorboards, I looked out to the river flowing beyond the big trees, and all at once you were just behind me, lying watching me, as you did years ago, and not stirring at all, when I reached back slowly, hoping to touch your long amber fur, and there we stayed without moving, listening to the river, and I wondered whether it might be a dream, whether you might be a dream, whether we both were a dream in which neither of us moved.
That's so beautiful. In another one of the poems, a river is like a line in the palm of the hand. So the imagery of this suite of poems is constantly transforming. There's a sense of things becoming human size, becoming enormous, becoming the size of a line on the palm of the hand. It feels as if also that these things are not achieved because of a conscious decision, but because of the naturalness with which poetic language comes to you now.
I don't even want to think about that because it would be for superstitious reasons, you know, because it can always stop. I believe that the muse is very watchful of a particular kind of arrogance, and she thinks, well, if you think you own it, I'll show you who owns it, you know. But what you say also makes me think of something I realized from time to time, aspects of something. The importance in my own imagination all of my life of rivers and streams. I don't understand that. I don't think it's something that one understands. One comes to recognize it. I think that's true of the arts too. I don't think one understands them. I think one recognizes. One doesn't understand Waiting for Godot. One recognizes something there and responds to it. But I grew up my first few years, we lived across the river, the Hudson, from New York. And I saw New York most of the time in those first 9 years across the river and completely silent. Now we live on Maui. Through our property runs the whole upper section of not a river, but a stream bed. And one of the remarkable things, it was very beautiful, very, very twisty and windy with lots of sort of small cliffs and big rocks, and but no water. The water was cut off 100 years ago when the planters stole all the water of that coast for irrigating the nascent sugarcane fields in the middle of the island. And it's never come back there. And that drove the Hawaiians off the land, which is another thing they wanted to do. But that stream bed and the Hawaiian remnants are part of the magic of that place to both of us. And I sit sometimes and just listen to that the silence of that small, beautiful valley, which, of course, is not silent. It's not utterly silent. There are whispers. There are the rustles of leaves and the sound of an occasional frog singing or a bird at night. And then, of course, you hear the birds waking up there. But it's the silence of that stream bed is another new thing. It's something that's really part of our lives now.
That's you and Paula, your wife.
Mm-hmm.
The gradations within silence or gradations within darkness or even within dream seem to be part of what your poetry teaches its readers, to perceive smaller and smaller and smaller nuances.
Doesn't all poetry do that to some degree?
To some degree, but not... Well, for instance, if we think of one of my favorites, Browning, when he begins by saying, "Grr, there goes my heart's abhorrence. What are your damn flower pots do if hate killed men, Brother Lawrence? Good Lord, would mine kill you?" We're not expecting careful gradations. We're expecting the hyperbole, the pleasure of hearing someone express surprising and comic anger. Yours now... I mean, in this book, as in others, there are many poems about your father. But now the gradation toward tenderness, forgiveness, not forgetfulness, but something just on the verge of forgetfulness. "I'm willing to let it go," says the poem. You know, it's an astonishing thing.
And, of course, at that stage, one remembers things one didn't before. But what you just said makes me think of a poet who meant a lot to me in adolescence was Milton. Less now, of course, but I don't know why, of course, but I mean the heavy rhetoric I steered away from after a while. But one of my favorite sonnets in English is a poem that answers your description too, that one, "Methought I saw my late espoused saint brought to me like Alcestis from the grave," about the wife whom he really loved, whom he never saw. And he dreams about her coming back. It ends, "But oh, as to embrace me, she inclined. I waked, she fled, and day brought back my night." The gradations happen in that poem so fast, and there are so many of them. And you say, there's a wonderful phrase in there, "and to my fancied sight," he said, she appeared this way. And, I mean, fancied in a dream, and fancied because, of course, he was blind. He never saw her at all. He was blind at 24.
Now, would you then perhaps suggest that to be a poet involves an ability to live between worlds?
Oh, yes. But I think in the imagination, one always lives between worlds. And there is no absolute. In the imagination, one deals with relatives all the time. I mean, and the moment you have a person experiencing and a thing experienced, you have something relative. There's nothing to be said about it, and there's no language to say it.
I guess in the imagination, anything can be accomplished, yes?
Oh, yes. Aren't our lives an example of that? Because our lives are certainly not what we think they are. Each one of us has a different image of this room at this moment. None of us is seeing the room just the way it really is. You know, the way it really is invisible. We don't see that.
I have a final question. It would once have been impossible for a poet to easily accept the invitation to be a country's poet laureate, this country's poet laureate. It certainly once would not have been possible for you. What makes it possible now?
When I was invited to do it, the terms of it were, we talked about that, and I was asked whether there was a theme that I would want to have as a sort of to string the whole thing on. And I said, yes, if I accept to do it, that will be one of the main reasons why I would do that. And the theme would be the something I want to talk about. My words won't change anybody's behavior. But the connection between the human imagination, which I think is the one really distinctive thing that humanity has, not intelligence or language, both of which are dubious in different ways, but imagination, the thing that allows us to sit here in the Palomar Hotel in Los Angeles and be distressed about the homeless people in Darfur and the whales dying of starvation in the Pacific, and elated by a little girl getting a prize for playing Mozart in China when she's 7 years old. You know, other animals have this quality, but it's not primal in their lives. It's not the center of their, and it's what makes us. You know, each one of us is here in our imagination, seeing the world a little bit differently. I think that this is our great talent. It's the source of compassion, and it's the source of our respect for the rest of life and for our gratitude for it, our love of the rest of life. And if we don't have that, we are in every sense deprived. In the etymological sense and in every other way, we're narrowed down to little selfish blobs destroying the world around us, and in so doing destroying ourselves. And that's what I think is the picture of our economic world right now, you know. I mean, quite apart from the economic crisis, which is certainly real, if our view of the world is simply what we can exploit for our own immediate advantage, our chances of survival are diminishing as fast as the forests and the purity of the waters are diminishing. We're going with them. We may not be able to reverse it. I don't know, but that may be our fatal flaw. You know that we're caught up in that behavior, and it's ours, and we don't have a very long lifespan. But I hope that's not true, because we're also the species that provided St. Teresa and Schweitzer and Mozart and Blake.
I've been talking with W.S. Merwin, author most recently of The Shadow of Sirius, published by the wonderful Copper Canyon Press. Thank you, William, for joining me.
Thank you, Michael.
You can find out more about the over 800 species of palms lovingly planted by Merwin over 30 years, and a home that reflects the cultural richness and sustainability practices of one of America's most honored poets, by checking out the website at www.merwinconservancy.org. You can comment on today's show at kcrw.com/bookworm. You can podcast this program, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with a click of a button on our media player at kcrw.com. My co-producer is Melinda Siegel. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Joining me today to help me at the Palomar Hotel are Connie Alvarez and Craig Erthine. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.